Welcome back, listeners, to Built to Lead Season 4, Rebels with a Cause. Today, it is our joy to be joined by Dr. Roberta Timothy. Dr. Timothy is the Black Health Lead at the Dalai Lama School of Public Health at the University of Toronto and founder of the Masters of Public Health in Black Health, which starts its inaugural cohort this September. Dr. Timothy strives for justice through efforts of decolonization, especially in the world of healthcare and social determinants of health. She has over 30 years of experience working in frontline community health, conducting her work through an anti-racist and anti-oppression lens. She is also a co-founder of Continuing Healing Consultants, where she has trained many practitioners in anti-oppression psychotherapy. For her work, she has been named a top 25 woman of influence in 2022, and the year before in 2021, the winner of the Doris Anderson Award. Welcome to Built to Lead, Dr. Timothy.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Our first question we want to start asking you is, in your opinion, what is a good rebel?
Well, what I think makes a good rebel is, or the characteristics of a good rebel are being authentically oneself, having empathy, compassion, taking a risk to speak up and act differently, even if you feel fair. Thinking outside of the box, engaging in creative thinking and doing. For me, it's seeing humor in almost everything. It helps me to deal with the nerves or the challenges that come my way when I dare to challenge the status quo in mainstream and community spaces. A good rebel reminds themselves that they are not only working in silos, but their acts of resistance are part of a larger movement. A good rebel acknowledges their mistakes openly and tries ways to communicate, act differently when needed. I come from generations of good rebels. It's part of my DNA, my ancestors, my children, and their children. My mommy was or is, in a spirit, a good rebel. I learned a lot from her.
And Roberta, I definitely believe you are a rebel. Even going back to last season, one of our favorite episodes, we got a lot of great feedback with Angela Robertson.
Oh, yeah.
She talks about joy and being a rebel and that resistance. And that's something that I've definitely seen you bring about. You talk about taking risks, challenging status quo. Even I just want to thank you for the work that you've done. Even just thinking back to, I think it was last year, you had an interview on TVO, and you talked about one of your goals was actually starting the creation of this Masters of Black Health. Right. So for you to take that risk, I think that's definitely being a rebel.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And that even brings us to our topic today in terms of diversity. This is a program that brings diversity to the program, to the world, and to Black health, and to the health system in general. And diversity is a pillar of the Rebel Talents, because when organizations embrace diverse perspectives and the people who foster them, they set themselves up to break the stereotypical ways of thinking.
Right.
So this means reducing bias traps and avoiding groupthink. So your work in diversity is anti-racist and anti-oppression based.
Yeah, yes, it is.
And for our listeners, they probably have a good understanding of what diversity is, but integrating anti-racist and anti-oppression thinking can be, I think, a little less intuitive.
Yes.
So what does it mean to be anti-racist, anti-oppressionist? Through your experiences, how did you develop this framework of thinking? And how can we cultivate this thinking as leaders in terms of anti-racist and anti-oppressionist?
Such a good question. I love the question. It means to be anti-racist and anti-oppressive, or anti-oppression, use anti-oppression. It means to prioritize and speak and act against, to support the dismantlement of racism, anti-Black racism, anti-Indigenous racism, anti-Asian racism, and other forms of intersectional violence, where what I call intersectional violence, sexism, heterosexism, classism, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, discrimination against Indigenous spiritualities, ageism, ableism, colonization. It is an ideology and a practice or praxis of anti-racism and anti-oppression. It's the constant fight for humanity and the call to interrupt or disrupt the systems that oppress and violate, often brutally, often physically, emotionally, financially, and spiritually. Folks who look and think like me, anti-racist and anti-oppression framework is the one leadership characteristic or character that has the potential, when actualized, to change the world as we know it. I feel very deeply about this and have seen the healing and wellness that can happen when we actively practice anti-racist and anti-oppression frameworks or processes. I developed this based on, really, I'm a part of a 400-year struggle. I come from a place of colonization and despair. I come from hope and resistance. As an African Black woman who was taken away from my community and brought forcibly to the Caribbean and Latin America, whose indigeneity was compromised, my language and religion banned, I've been raised on anti-racism and anti-oppression. My mom tells a story about me as a three-year-old being in the TTC and stating very loudly why there's no Black bus drivers. And this is a while ago, right, when there wasn't any. I did that at the doctor's office. Why is there no Black doctors? At the bank, why is there no Black bank tellers? The school, teachers, et cetera, et cetera. I always knew and felt that discrimination, or what I would say racism, I was hypersensitive to the exclusion and disdain and violence that my community was experiencing. My mommy was active in the anti-violent community or anti-violence community, anti-apartheid and pan-African movements. So I grew up as a kid marching and protesting and boycotting against racism and other forms of oppression. I didn't know anything differently than how to resist and how to fight back. As a child, I met and was around leaders who dedicated their life to change and anti-racism and anti-oppression. I grew up in the working class neighborhood in Scarborough and experienced extreme acts of racism, racist violence that still impact me today. For me, Canada was never a friendly or polite space. It was a constant battlefield where I had to try and survive and still do so differently though now. Hence my experience of racist violence, class violence, and gender violence, and seeing Black, Indigenous, racialized, mainly women, at least in the anti-violence women's movement and in the Pan-African spaces, Black men and Black women, also leading our communities to fight for our rights locally and globally. Leaders needed to check themselves, their locations, their unearned privileges. Who and why are they leading? I encourage folks to lead in ways that allow folks to gain self and community empowerment, to interrupt status quo, white supremacy. What would happen if all the health leaders decided to stop and actually support the solutions, for example, of water shortages in Indigenous communities or housing inequities or apartheid in quote-unquote inner cities in Toronto? It's not rocket science. We know that anti-Indigenous racism, anti-Black racism is at work. What a difference leaders can, working from an anti-racism or anti-oppression perspective, can make. We can challenge a lot of the decisions that are being made in our healthcare system, and we can start supporting folks who are really being harmed and violated in various ways. So an anti-racist, anti-oppression framework, leadership, is one of the most powerful tools of change that we have today to actually dismantle some of these acts of violence or problems that are existing within our healthcare system today.
The conversation up to now has been so energizing. I'm listening as you're sharing the different concepts and frameworks and, you know, different ways to cultivate the thinking that is required to, you know, really push the movement forward and to prioritize the change. What really stood out from what you just said was, I think, this bold statement of stop and support. Yes. You know, I think there's this current notion in today's society where kind of these anti-racist, anti-oppressionalist theories are like working in parallel with things that are happening in today's time, versus it's like we need to stop what we're doing, focus on it, prioritize it, and then we can do things with it, rather than doing it, you know, parallel with other things, because we're not giving it the full attention that it deserves in order to push a movement forward and kind of really lead towards that change. So I really appreciate that statement, you know, that stop and support, just stop.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of pivot the conversation a little bit and kind of talk about how you've been involved in leading the Black women and women of African descent, which had its inceptions at the Ontario Institute of Studies and Education. Can you tell us a little bit more about this leadership and what it meant to be a part of this group?
Definitely. Thank you. So it's an autonomous group, and that's important that it did come from, I was at OISE and we started there, but it didn't come from the educational system at OISE. It came as an autonomous group, and it came out of a need. I started it in 2003 as a PhD student at OISE, and it was to support Black women graduate students initially who were struggling with isolation and the impact of anti-Black racism and misogynoir. It was a place to come together and support each other with academic and personal dilemmas. It was also a place to get a smile, a hug, and help on your thesis work. But it moved into even, you know, something broader, over the oh my gosh, it's 20 years now. Wow, 20 years. It moved into helping Black women get into university outside from the community. So other community members would, you know, contact me. I would meet in coffee shops. I would meet at houses. Did some groups also in terms of how to get into university. And also expanded to even supporting some people to get teaching positions and academic positions. And also it moved to supporting Black men. Black feminist perspectives, which this group stands for, we always support Black families, which include our feminism, include Black men. So I still mentor folks individually and in group. It's passing it on. It's each one teach one logic. It's village love. How do we survive and thrive together, and how do we support each other? I had a lot of experience growing up in the Canadian context because I grew up here, and going through an educational system that was really violent and problematic. So my goal with the Black, or we call it BWAD, the Black Women of African Descent group, was to support people to support themselves to have experiences that were less challenging than, you know, mine and others, and to have a kind of a smoother way or integration into the educational system. And 20 years later, I can't believe it's 20 years. It doesn't even feel like that. It's something that I love to do. I do it for free. It's autonomous. It's how I support and mentor the community. And I've seen other folks, you know, go on, get degrees, get work in different organizations and spaces. And they're also doing the same in terms of mentoring the next generations. And it's just it's a gift to be a part of this group. And it's a gift to continue to challenge folks in terms of who has the right to an education and who has the right to be supported through and not. And within this group, we deal with transgenerational trauma that happens. And we go through, you know, the quote unquote imposter syndrome, which I definitely debunk, because I actually believe when a system is violating you, you're not the imposter. it's been a passion, and it's been a great mentoring and leadership experience for me.
Before I share the follow-up, I do want to recognize and congratulate you on the 2 decades of this work. I mean, it's such an accomplishment. It's such a long time. I can't even imagine the amount of lives that you've impacted, the group has impacted altogether. And yeah. I think there's a specific theme that I wanted to highlight, and it's this theme of networks and supports, right? Yeah. I loved when you said village love. I kind of got like a few goosebumps just hearing it, because it's so important. And I think it's sometimes missed, it kind of operating in such a fast paced world that we currently live in. Right. Just an overall question for you. So how did the members of the Black Women of African Descent break through from being a solidarity group to leveraging that strength and solidarity, right? To making an impact and change within organizations, which you were a part of. And I'd love for you to kind of also speak on your perspective on the importance of having those networks and supports in general. And how does that change the entire narrative?
I think the network started very informally. And I still would say it's an informal group. But I think that it's a group that, because of the time and seeing what people have actually done, so creating people to lead and to support each other, has then kind of created, now it's 20 years, which I didn't even know. So that tells you something. That it's created a place where we can actually call up for folks. So when I need mentors for new people who are coming in or wanting to come into academia or to come into community in particular ways, there's now a set of folks who have already gone through the process of, you know, coming to BWAD, being a member in BWAD, and now they're mentoring other folks. So it really is a process of shared support, right? You've been supported, and now you're going to support other folks. And this has now expanded to other groups also, in terms of mentoring Black students at DALA, and even having mentoring programs for folks in general who are university professors. So the solidarity, I think, in the group is what people got from the group. And what people got from the group was care, was hope, was love, was a place to be able to say, you know what, I don't know how I'm going to get into this program, or I don't have family supports, or I don't have financial supports. And moving through all of those places to a place where you see people graduating, for a place to people who go to an organization and even talk about BWAD. Like, people, sometimes I'm in meetings and somebody said, I remember I was in BWAD, you know, I was in BWAD and they supported me to do this, and now I'm doing my master's in social work, and I just completed it, and now I'm hired in working with children, and I'm bringing that same kind of each one teach one or village love with folks who are in the organization. So I think in terms of the support and solidarity, and even leveraging it, we don't even know. I don't think I know the capacity of what has actually happened with the supports of BWAD, because people have gone on to work in so many places and spaces, and they're still bringing that village love. My main thing is to folks, you know, people have like, hey, do you want a jerk chicken? Do you want jollof rice? Like, people want to pay you, right, for the support, you know, like, and, you know, food is always good. And I'm like, you know, the payment is, first of all, for you to receive the love and the care, and for you to do it for somebody else. That's all I ask for people. Can you do it to somebody else in other spaces and places? And I think that's what's happening. And I grew up in these various activist spaces and movements, right? Seeing these brilliant caucusing and getting together for similar goals. I've also experienced the challenges of collective work. Like, I've seen bad networks and really, you know, power dynamics and racism. Working in the anti-violence women's community, you know, networking was sometimes challenging, and sometimes it was done really well. But networking with members who are supportive is life-changing. Mm-hmm. It really can create change when a group is working together to achieve a change. Like, it's pretty amazing to see how that can work. I think the gift is also mine. I want to say that. The gift is also mine. The learning and the unlearning and what I learned from doing this. This is not, I teach people to teach themselves also how to lead. Like, leadership is about folks leading. It's not about having one leader, right? I mean, even under, you know, even the great leaders that we've seen in the world, there's a community of leaders that are with them. But, you know, unfortunately, we kind of only see the end result of one person speaking, but there's really a community. And I'm not a leader without the other folks who are leading. Like, I can't lead that way, right? So I lead in community. I lead myself, and I hope to support other folks to be leaders also. And that's what we've done within this group.
It's almost like building a network of networks.
And yeah.
Keeping that flourishing,
yeah,
as you continuously grow. And there was this one specific statement that you made that really stood out. And I was in my head thinking, and you said, you know, it's almost like a repayment of love.
Yeah.
It's like a repayment of action and energy.
Yes.
To be honest, as much as in today's time we talk about recession in the currency of money,
yeah,
I think we're also in a recession of consultation. We're in a recession of partnership.
Yes.
We're in a recession of love and healing.
Yes.
Because people are so independently functioning,
yep,
that we're forgetting that we're a part of this bigger picture where if we don't hold hands and work together in consultation or partnership,
yep,
that in essence, like how economies fall, we fall.
100%.
And so I loved how you brought that notion of kind of repayment of love into the conversation. I did want to quickly pivot and say, you know, you've recently founded and launched in the inaugural cohort of the Master of Public Health and Black Health at the University of Toronto. And first and foremost, a huge congratulations on doing this. I feel like this is such a huge accomplishment.
Thank you so much.
What role do you see programs like this, or the Masters of Public Health and Indigenous Health, for example, having in terms of driving the greater disruption or good trouble or rebelling within our system?
I love good trouble. Good trouble is good. Really good.
Absolutely.
I think programs like this are needed everywhere. I mean, we can't have one program sustain the needs of change that's needed to actually revamp, dismantle our healthcare system and really create wellness and healing for folks. So I think that what this program does and what other programs like it do is it challenges the inevitableness, right, that these systems can't change. They can, and they are doing so. Programs like this talk back to systems that exclude, harm, and cause pain as we boldly say and act in ways to disrupt the thinking and practice in healthcare. And I'm so excited about that. Teaching and supporting practitioners to go out into various health spaces and challenge and change the gaps, the violence, by changing the script, the curriculum. The ask in itself is powerful, right? It's the hope is to not only challenge systems that are creating harm or creating violence for, you know, Black, Indigenous, and purposely marginalized communities, but also to create something new, to learn from various Indigenous ways of knowing, and I'm talking about locally and globally, and to really create health systems of wellness and of care. So I think this program is, as I said, you know, many a time before, it's ancestral led. I'm a part of the program, but something bigger and something more greater than me, right, has supported this program to be. And I think the various leadership and even folks that have gone before us that have fought to have a program such as Black Health, you know, we have an Indigenous health program, and we're definitely in solidarity to both programs. I think this is game-changing and life-changing for so many folks to actually prioritize Black health, particularly in a state of emergency. We are in a state of emergency for Black health in our community, in our world, and to have a program that actively challenges the exclusion and the lack of data and the lack of priority or prioritizing Black health. I think this program is one factor in doing so. It's, you know, it's only one engine. So we need more engines, and we need to know that this system is not inevitable. We can change, and we are changing the system.
There's a quick metaphor that I can think of that I've heard in the past that I think can be applied here, where it's, you know, you might not see the fruits of your labor right now, but what you've done is you've planted a seed where the fruition or the leaves or the fruit will come in the times ahead. And I almost feel like if we're thinking about this like a tree, I feel like the ancestral conversation that you're sharing, it's like they planted a seed for you to have the roots to then have this program as a branch that will then produce fruit,
produce
individuals, change makers, good rebels that will then go into society and rebuild and relearn and unlearn. And it's going to go through the cyclical nature, which
100%,
which I love. So thank
through,
you so much.
Through village love, right? It's doing it through village love.
Exactly.
Yeah. The water, yeah. The water and the constant sunlight.
Yes. Yeah. You gotta put love and growth, right? You gotta put seeding, you gotta make sure everything is feeling good so that the tree can grow stronger and the branches can grow, you know, thicker and the greener. So it's an honor to be doing this program, really.
I love it. Thank you.
Thank you,
Dr. Timothy, on creating that space where future leaders in healthcare can receive cultural training and build cultural sensitivity health services. But sadly, this is a perfect time to end part one of this episode. In part two, Matthew and I continue our discussion with Dr. Timothy on mentorship and fostering good rebel leadership.
Thank you for listening today, and thank you for joining us on Built to Lead Season 4, Rebels with a Cause. Built to Lead is created and hosted by Matthew Goldburn
and co-hosted by Mubin Lalani.
Built to Lead is a companion podcast to the Vernissage Health Dialogue Series at the Institute of Health Policy, Management, and Evaluation at the University of Toronto.
Tell us what you thought about this week's episode. You can find us on LinkedIn at Vernissage Health and on Instagram at Vernissage Health. You'll find both of these in the episode description. Today's episode was produced by
Dheeraj Thakur,
Matthew Goldburn, with music composed by Sindhu.
A special thanks to Wendy Nelson, Senior Fellow at the Institute of Health Policy, Management and Evaluation. Until next time.